No, we were supposed to start an hour.
We do not have a quorum, but we're going to get the meeting started. If we could have Representative Anderson take this place. Representative Anderson, I will move that House File 595. I'm sorry, I can't move it yet. That's right, we don't have a quorum. See, I can blame sleep deprivation all day long on various glitches. And Representative Huntley, I don't even belong to the Curmudgeons Club yet. Are there dues, by the way, to that club?
Oh, big.
Big dues, okay. All right. Well, Representative Anderson, welcome to the committee, and thank you, by the way, for your cooperation work on this. I'm tempted to come up and help present with you, but why don't you get started with House File 595?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The members, House File 595 was presented to this committee back in April of last year, and the bill was, from the overview from House Research, said it was to remove the current moratorium on construction of radiation therapy facilities located in certain metropolitan counties, which was enacted in 2007. This bill provides an immediate effective date, and now we have new language that has come forward to amend House File 595. It's a DE1 amendment, and once you have the wherewithal to move the bill for me, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson, I'll move the DE1 amendment, and we can speak to it, or why don't we put it on to make get the bill in the shape it should be in, and then we can talk about it.
Mr. Chair, do you have a quorum to do that now?
That's true. We can't even move the bill yet, can we? How close are we?
Don't mean to tell you
right.
How to do it.
Why don't we start talking about the DE1 then?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The DE1, members, is in regards to construction of radiation therapy facilities, which limits construction to entities owned, operated, and or controlled by a hospital. And that construction time frame is to expire August 1st, 2014. That's the first section of the DE1 amendment. Section B provides an exception to the existing moratorium on construction of these facilities in the metropolitan area by stating the moratorium does not apply as of January 1st, 2013 to relocation of a machine from Maplewood to Woodbury. Section C establishes new criteria for construction of these facilities, and that will be effected upon expiration of the existing restriction and moratorium August 1st, 2014. It provides that an entity constructing the radiation therapy facility must be controlled by or under common control of a hospital and must be located at least 7 miles from an existing radiation therapy facility. Section D requires referring physicians to provide patients with a list of all radiation therapy facilities located in the 14-county metro area, requires physicians with a financial interest in a radiation therapy facility to disclose them to that to patients. I do have, Mr. Chairman, a list of radiation therapy facilities, a copy to give to every one of the members here.
Representative Anderson, what I'm going to do is interrupt right now and just call the meeting officially to order now that we have a quorum, and let's take care of a little bit of business. We have minutes, and I'll entertain a motion from anybody at this point. I usually pick someone, but oh my goodness, look at every. Should we have a wrestling
match? Mr. Chair. As the first one in the hearing room today, I think I should move the minutes because I've had so much time to read them.
Well, I understand that. I understand that could be in dispute as to which one of you is it. See, so, I mean, all right. Well, who wants to? I'm gonna say Representative Moran is moving the minutes. Oh. I'm sorry, you just lost out.
And so moved.
So moved. Very good. All right. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, and the minutes of March 20th are adopted. I will also move the DE1 amendment so we have this bill in the order that it's supposed to be in.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, I'm sorry. First, I got to move the bill. My CA is keeping me in line here. Okay, I will move that House File 595 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All those in... I mean, it'd be nice to do that, wouldn't it? Okay, so we've moved that. Now I'm going to move the DE1 amendment. And all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Those opposed? The DE1 amendment passes, and now we are on House File 595 as amended. And Representative Anderson, I'm just going to share with the committee a little bit to help out here. This was a bill we laid over last year. We've had this controversy around the legislature for a long time about permanent moratorium, temporary moratorium, no moratorium with regard to radiation oncology facilities in the 14-county metro area. Over this session and well, for the last several months, we've had some very, I would say, difficult and but productive meetings with all the parties involved to arrive at what we consider a compromise, a set of criteria or standards that we would then put in law that would end the moratorium, but again, with these standards in place to make sure that things that we don't want to have happening are happening. Representative Anderson was carrying the bill that was the elimination of the moratorium. Representative Hamilton was carrying the bill that made it permanent. Both of them have agreed to work on this, and we have both sides really coming together. Not everybody terribly happy with the outcome, but that tends to be kind of the nature of compromise. So that's a little bit of history on how this came forward. And so Representative Anderson's bill had been laid on the table. Not laid on the table. It had been laid over. Last session, and now we're bringing it back, and so that's kind of a little bit of history. Representative Hamilton's bill, by the way, exact same language is being heard in Commerce today as well. So we are getting this language heard in the legislature in hopes. Parties we've all talked to are glad we're arriving at this conclusion. It's been a lot of hard work. So that's just a little bit of background about why this bill is here, why we brought the DE1 amendment, and Representative Anderson just walked through what it contained. And you have some additional information, I think, too, Representative Anderson, if you want to share some of that.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. Basically, in Section E, we have the definition of the phrases controlled by and under common control with, and you can see that in the DE1 amendment. Section F provides a definition of the phrase financial interest in any radiation therapy facility. Section G provides that the limitations and conditions established under this section do not apply to relocation or reconstruction of existing radiation therapy facilities if ownership of the facility remains unchanged. The relocation or reconstruction and is within 1 mile of an existing facility, and the time period between closing the existing facility and opening the relocated or reconstructed facility is 12 months or less. And then the big section is for the Department of Health and Human Services, the commissioner, to have a study of radiation therapy facilities and their capacity throughout the metro area. That is to be done and submitted back to the legislature by March 15th, 2013. And that is kind of the conclusion roundabout way. And this is kind of the little bit of an insight of where our therapy centers are right now.
Representative Anderson, I want to thank you because this agreement came together fairly recently, and so he is bringing forward this DE1 amendment with not a lot of time to prepare, but thank you. You did a great job of walking through it. Members, I'd open it up for questions. I'm sure there will be some. Again, this has been the result of some really difficult but productive negotiations. And the same language, by the way, has moved on the Senate side as well. So the goal is to try to get this done and have that go forward rather than do the moratorium, no moratorium thing in the legislature. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have a question. I just have a comment. This is really good news for people in my district. All of Washington County has not had radiation oncology, and so the fact that we can now move that machine from the Maplewood site to the Woodlands Hospital is just really, really good news. So thank you very much, Representative Anderson, and thanks.
Representative Huntley.
Again, it's a comment. One of the things we're always concerned about is overutilization of healthcare. If you build too many facilities there, they're just going to order more and more of these procedures. However, this procedure is one that's never over-ordered. There's a real downside to using these kinds of things, but they, and if a physician recommended somebody get this kind of service and that patient didn't need it, that physician would probably lose his license. So this is not an issue of overutilization. I've been involved in this fight for too many years. But both sides, well, actually there's three sides. The one side is silent. They both are the ones that have been in here lobbying, do a good job with their patients. I have no concern about that. And I don't think we have an overutilization problem, so I don't know why we don't allow new facilities. And you can, I can accept the argument that they shouldn't be across the street and so on. So, but I think this is a good solution, and I think we should all support it.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, on this one, we should maybe sit on the other side of the table, Representative Huntley. You know, I don't think overutilization is the problem, but I think overbilling is a problem. And when you have a lot of these facilities that, and you've overbuilt, the temptation is to increase your to the billing to cover it. And these are very expensive facilities. And in the bill, and this is the one line here that particularly concerns me, we have some of the pressure to build this is I think from physicians who have a financial interest in these facilities. And I'm glad to see there's a line here that says 2.8, physicians with a financial interest in any radiation therapy facility must disclose to the patient the existence of the interest. You know, that's all well and good. I'm not sure. You know, physicians have a lot of leverage on patients. Patients go to them, they trust them. And that's good when it comes to, what they're recommending for your health problem or that's good. People should be able to trust their physicians. But financial incentives to physicians are a very insidious thing. We see this in a lot of places, and I don't mean to single out physicians by any means, but we see this throughout healthcare. And when we're talking about even in our medical assistance or in Medicare, I believe it was, there's the sort of famous study or famous article by Atul Gawande, who's a physician, who I think he's a surgeon, and he wrote an article in The New Yorker a few years ago trying to explore, find out why does Medicare cost so much more in some places in the country than other places. I don't know if anybody else has heard of this. If you haven't, I'm going to send you a copy of the article. It's very, very instructive. And what he comes down to, he's doing this as a physician, just curious guy, and he's also a very good writer, and he says, why does the federal government spend so much more in some parts of the country than in others? And here in Minnesota, by the way, it's pretty low. What makes the difference? And a lot of the difference, it turns out, is who owns the facilities. So where you have physicians who also own the MRI, the radiation facility, what you get is escalating costs. Not that anybody thinks they're doing anything wrong. Nobody thinks they're referring for something a patient doesn't need. But when you own the means of giving it to them, there is a natural pressure to increase that use. And that is a big driver in our medical system. And it really concerns me. Here in Minnesota, we've had this moratorium. I've supported it because, even though there are certainly some arguments on the other side, it's not all black and white. But it really concerns me when we have physicians who are going to refer to radiation facilities that they have a financial interest in, and that we're going to be now building, under this compromise, I assume we're going to be building more of those facilities in which a physician has a direct financial interest. And it troubles me and bothers me that all we're going to do to try to control that is have them disclose it to the patient. And, I just don't think that's enough. When you go to a physician and you've got cancer and they're telling you you need treatment and they say, and by the way, the best facility for this treatment is that one on the corner, and I do have a financial incentive in it, but that's not why I'm sending you there. It's really the best, and I know that because I work there, and I want to make sure you get the best care. And what is that patient going to say? Are they going to say, well, doctor, I'm not going to the one that you have a financial interest in? I just don't think that's enough of a safeguard for people when they're in this very vulnerable situation of being needing cancer care. So I'm concerned about this, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling, believe me, that was the centerpiece of many, many long discussions, not only between the two parties, but among many others. And part of the reason this is in front of us is that, you know, nowhere else in the nation do we do a blanket moratorium. It's a very blunt instrument. I've often believed that as the state legislature ought to be in the position of having policy, and that we apply that policy uniformly. So let's identify the things that give us heartburn or that concern us about adding cost or hurting patient care or quality or choice, and put that in statute, and then let that guide. You know, if somebody meets those criteria, then they're able to move ahead, and if they don't, they don't. This is a pretty strict set of criteria. And the geographic distance helps with that. My sense is part of the cost of these facilities also prohibits against it. You're not going to see somebody investing tens of millions of dollars in a facility like this unless the pro forma works out. It's not going to be like Burger King versus McDonald's. That just doesn't happen in these instances. So I'm convinced we're not adding to the cost of patient care. The whole issue of self-referral was the centerpiece of our discussion, and we put a lot of the language in here to address that and feel we have really tried to do that as best we can right now. Like I said, both sides came to the table and gave up something, and I think both of them feel I wouldn't be speaking out of school to say I think one side is very concerned about the 7-mile radius being too large, and the other side may be feeling like they're giving up a little too much too. And the art of compromise is sometimes that you don't get everything you like. But I think this puts us on the ground of being in the position of the legislature applying policy and not just saying no to everybody, but allowing others to go ahead. So I wanted to share that as part of the negotiation. I think it is a good thing to go ahead with. Representative, first of all, are there any other testifiers for or against? I know that the principals of the two groups are in the room here. If they feel strongly they'd like to say something, that's fine. Otherwise, other people might have a desire to testify. Seeing none, I'll go to Representative Barrett.
No, Mr. Chair, that was my question. I just wanted to know if there's anyone in the audience who wanted to testify for or against.
Very good. I would also point out, just to put this on the record, this is intended for the 14-county metro area. And we are in discussion with people about whether or not we need to add that language more clearly. But it is clearly intended to be 14-county, not to the rest of Minnesota. Many of you know I serve on the Rural Health Advisory Committee to the Department of Health. We don't want these criteria necessarily to be applied to people who live in a place where there's very little health care already. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to make a statement to committee and to Representative Liebling. When my wife contracted cancer, the doctor told her where he thought she should go for her radiation treatments, and we went. It was actually just for a scan, and when we came back, before we actually got the results back, some friends of ours had said, you know, you should get a second opinion on that scan. So when we came back, the doctor showed us the scan, showed us what the results were of that scan, and we asked then for a second opinion from, and he said it was amazing, he made so many different recommendations of where he would say to go, and it was just across the board of different places, and we selected several other places to go to. So I was very surprised and pleased with the doctor, that the oncologist that we had in making that recommendation, that it wasn't just his recommendation to go there, and he recommended other places to go besides that. So I was very, very surprised and very pleased in that, even in an emotional state that we were in at the time. And I think that, you know, our state public policy should be to encourage and not stifle something of this magnitude, where we have the ability to deliver healthcare system be nice if we could do it nationwide or statewide, but at least for the 14 county metro area that we're looking at here, to allow that delivery to not have any impediments to thwart it from being made available to all the necessary individuals and families that are looking for it. So I appreciate your support and this effort.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, one other thing that strikes me as I'm looking at this, and thank you for that, Representative Anderson, is that you've got the study. The study is here in the bill. And, you know, I think there have been studies in the past. Maybe it's time for another study. But, Mr. Chair, I just think it would be so much better to study first and let people start building afterwards, you know, to study and then change the policy. Because, you know, these are very expensive facilities. Once you get them started, you're committed. You know, you can't say, okay, now you can start planning and start building, and then, whoops, we're over. We've got too much capacity. So I just think I would really like to see us, you know, maybe we should have done the study last year, but we didn't, you know. So I would feel much more comfortable with that. I guess I could just ask, why are we not doing it that way, Representative Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling,
Representative Anderson,
I think as Representative Lohmer has mentioned, and as people who wanted the moratorium lifted, there were projects that have been in the on the list for years, waiting to get some kind of action, and they were just waiting for the ability for the legislature to lift this and say, let's go forward with that. They already had the resources in line to make it happen. They just needed the permission to do it, and I think the study will come back and hopefully verify exactly what we're looking for.
Well, and Representative Liebling, I would also add, these are not things like houses that you put up in 6 months. They require a great deal of planning and preparation. And even if they found that we had passed the rules at the end of this session and wanted to begin planning one, it takes a long time. This study will be back before any of those are built or even permitted. So that is the nature of it. And I again, yeah, the negotiations around does the state use the blunt instrument of a moratorium to completely prevent these things, or do we set some criteria in place that are reasonable and pretty tough? On the self-referral issue, patients have to be given all of the providers in the entire area a list of those by anybody choosing to do this. So they in a sense, they're given the choice of all of those providers. And that was an important part of this. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question might be for you or whomever was involved in the discussions. One of the arguments that we've heard over the course of the discussion of the moratorium and whether or not to lift it is that by lifting the moratorium, we would be able to build more integrated systems or integrated centers that would make patient care more easy for people who are going through cancer treatment. And so the majority of the bill is about the 14-county metro area, or 14 counties in the metro area. But the study appears to have a statewide look. And I heard you say that, you know, at least the Section 1 doesn't apply to greater Minnesota, but I think it would be important to understand in the course of the study sort of the disbursement of radiation therapy in greater Minnesota, because there I would expect that patients have to go much further to get to a center, and their experience is much different than in the metro area where we're living in a really compressed area. And as I read through that Section 2, I think it could capture it, but I'm not sure that it captures it. So I'm just wondering if there's, as this moves forward, if there's room to insert a little more language to make sure that we're contemplating that statewide look.
Well, Representative Murphy, I'll be real honest. Changing language right now is going to be really tough, mm-hmm. because this came out of a lot of, mm-hmm. it was a difficult negotiation process, to say the least. It's certainly something to look at, but I too would be interested in seeing what it says for rural Minnesota as well as the 14 counties, and that information might in fact be useful to the state. We've talked in the Rural Health Advisory Committee about how, maybe mobile facilities are a way to help extend care out into rural areas from regional centers, for example. But it would be interesting to see what the impediments to care, whether it's distance or lack of facilities out in rural Minnesota, might be impacting people in greater Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chair, then I consider my me dropping a dime on this. And, as you move forward with this, it might be something you can contemplate. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Representative Kiffmeyer, Representative McDonald, and Representative Peterson. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Washington County is a highly populated area. There's a lot of things, but that's kind of a new growth area. And it's been a bit, you don't have some of those things over on that side. I live on the west side of the state. It's so different than when you're over on the east side towards that area. So I'm very sympathetic to that. I think it's easy sometimes when you maybe live in a city or a Rochester area or something like that, you can just so easily take that for granted. And yet, you have a very large county area there that has need of services. I did think, Representative Murphy, on page 2 there, in that study, I was wondering if on line 2.29 it says within the state. So it seems like, without changing any language or whatsoever, that this is taking a look beyond that county area. So I agree with you. I think, there are needs all everybody has, and it's good to be able to have these treatments close to home wherever you can. But I would think maybe this might be able to be done in this language.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for the author, Representative Anderson. I see in the section 2, the study, actually what Representative Liebling referred to, which I do concur, that it is important for this study. This was an issue that many on both parts of the aisle, some were for, some were against, and made up some great arguments for and against. But I'm curious, after the study is done and then it's given to the commissioner, what is the intent of the study? What do we hope to gain from it? And then I'll preface it with the existing treatment facilities that are 7.1 miles away from any new facilities that may be built. What kind of data can we extrapolate from those facilities? And if it is found in the data that those facilities cannot financially be sustainable anymore because of the competition, which generally competition is good, what can we do? What is the commissioner going to do with that data or this body in the future?
Representative McDonald, I think I'll take that since we negotiated in our group. First of all, I think the study was a certain amount of comfort language to say we're going to look at this. As Representative Murphy mentioned a moment ago, we'd like to know a little bit more about how this is playing out in the metro area and in greater Minnesota. I think there was a desire to have some external objective analysis of that issue, but these are not the sort of places that are going to get built if they're not financially feasible. As I mentioned in my comments to Representative Liebling before, nobody's going to invest that kind of money without knowing pretty darn sure that they've got something that is meeting a need, has sufficient patients, and can cash flow. So what I think it's designed to do is to look at the area. The 7 miles, frankly, was a compromise. There was talk about going as big a ring as 10 miles and even bigger, all the way down to something very small, more like a 2 or 1 mile radius. And so there was a lot of back and forth, and the agreement was to do the 7 miles. The study might give us some more indication of whether the geographic area may be no issue whatsoever, or maybe it'll say it should be a larger ring. Others have said that maybe a study's not necessary. We do an awful lot of them around here, as Representative Liebling has pointed out. But I think that was the discussion around having the study in there, was to have some eyes up, objective eyes on how is this playing out in the metro area, and then also extending to other parts of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Thank you for that. No, I'm full aware. I know that anyone... Any new facilities are a money maker. There's no doubt. Of course, they're not going to build them unless they are financially stable and sustainable. So, no, I didn't indicate that. My point was that the existing facilities, because on my point of view, I'm understanding that the existing facilities now who need this in their hospitals will have the potential of not being sustainable. And that was a big argument, I mean, on that. But this is a compromise that the group came to, and we all have to accept it. And much like the government, the compromise with the governor last year, we all don't get what we want. And that's government, I guess. That's politics. And we move forward. But I look forward to seeing the study. I don't like studies just for the sake of studies. I hope we can use it for the betterment of Minnesotans and our ability to pass law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative McDonald, I would just point out, too, there is a requirement among the three major requirements in this compromise is that it has to be associated with a hospital. So these are not standalone facilities, but that's part of the reason is we want to keep the hospital strong and connected with this. So Representative Liebling will take you out of turn because I think you want to comment on this, right?
Yeah, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say to Representative McDonald, you know, parties come to us with compromises all the time, and we're not bound by them. That's why we have this committee process. And, you know, you and I are here to represent our constituents and do what we think is the best for the state. And I really appreciate your reference to the data, because I think this really should be about data. And, you know, I don't know to what degree the various parties think their interests are met by this compromise. You know, sometimes people are kind of pressed into a compromise because, you know, they think the alternative may be worse. I don't know. And sometimes that has to do with things other than the real merits of the issue, too. And I don't know whether this one meets that or not. But I just want to say that, you know, I just want to support you in your questioning about this, because you're still pretty new at this. And I just think that, you know, we each of us, we're, even though some of us are, you know, have been here longer or shorter, whatever, we are all equally members of this body. We all hold equal election certificates, and we're all equally both empowered and responsible to question and do what we think is the right thing.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Representative McDonald did express some of the concerns I have. Obviously, I have some concerns about hospitals. And when you talk about Greater Minnesota, I think it's even more important because the hospitals there really need to be sustained for those communities. And this may, you know, having those facilities may be one way of helping them to remain open, actually. And I hope the study, you know, deals with some of those issues. But even in the metro area, and I, of course, North Memorial Hospital is in my area, and that's a level one trauma center. And they do a lot of uncompensated care, much uncompensated care. And they're really struggling within the metro area to stay open. And one of the services that they do offer are the centers, you know, that we're talking about here. And it's important for them. They've spent a lot of money on them, and they're good. I think they're well-staffed. And if they lose those, you know, that's one piece of income that is important to them. And I think when we look at the study, I hope that we look at the sustainability of our hospitals. And I don't know at this point, it doesn't say in here, at least as I read it, what the relationship of the hospitals will be to these radiation centers. To me, 7 miles is nothing. You know, I mean, in the metro area, I can drive seven. I mean, we all drive, at least I drive 25 miles to get here every day. And so anyway, I'm wondering, is there, I'm going to ask the author, was there any discussion about what kind of relationship there will be between these facilities and the hospitals?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, the discussion was basically between Representative Gotwell and key holders in the process here. So I really wasn't privy to all the information here. So I guess I would give it back to Representative Gotwell and ask him to give some background for that.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Peterson, the work group was actually much broader than myself. It was the stakeholders and others But if you look at the top of page 2, 2.1, the entity constructing the radiation therapy facility is controlled by or is under common control with a hospital licensed under sections 144.50 to 144.56. It's very specific. And it was intended to be that way, and both parties were concerned about that and shared the concern that that the connection of the hospitals be maintained. And this does apply to 14 counties, you know, the rural areas. Again, the study goes statewide, but the application of this is in the greater metro area. Much of that language is there primarily because of the concern for maintaining these facilities and maintaining distance from these facilities so that we could keep them strong at the hospitals that need them.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And does this mean that there will be, for instance, when it says controlled by, will there still be negotiations then between the facility and the hospital as to, you know, the financial aspects of the agreement? Are there, when it says controlled by, or does the hospital just get to make those particular decisions?
Representative Peterson, the way it is set up right now, you could not build one of these facilities unless it is part of a hospital operation.
Okay.
And again, that's it's right here in the language, how that's laid out. But that was a tough point in negotiation. It really was. There were there was one side that would have liked to have, you know, cut the strings on that, and there was another side that felt strongly about it. And we, right along as we talked about the state moving from this blunt instrument, a moratorium, to criteria, it was one of the three criteria always. The self-referral aspect, which Representative Liebling spoke to, association with a hospital, and then geographic distance were always kind of the three pieces that kept coming up in conversation. And so those is, you wouldn't be surprised to find, are the centerpiece in this compromise. And then the study came along, too, wanting to have an objective look at what the situation is here and elsewhere in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do remember this bill last year. One of the things, when I've looked at three of these facilities, and one thing that I didn't think about until after I was at the groundbreaking for Mayo's new high energy facility, and some of the discussions of where they talked about how many patients in a 24/7 you could work through the facility. I then asked the third facility when I toured it what sort of capacity, and I discovered it was single shift. It was around the, you know, 60-70% capacity, and I noticed the difference. So I think this study would be a great way of looking at it, because, you know, again, if you're going to spend millions upon millions of dollars on these facilities, I would hope that they would look at utilization that stretched greater than a single shift in Monday through Friday. So I see a lot of good in this bill. And I can support this compromise.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I have no one else on the list right now. Any further discussion? If not, I will renew my motion that House File 595, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the bill is passed to Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anderson,
thank you, members.
And thank you to all the people who participated in this process. Representative Norton, we're going to do your bill next. And Representative Lohmer. Co-presenters, bipartisan.
Here we go.
Yeah.
So now you get to decide which one's going to move the bill.
Well, we have two separate bills. One, I suspect, will move to the floor, and the other, you'll have to decide what you want to do with it. So I would move House File 1683 to be
recommended to pass and go where
to the floor.
To the floor. Very good. All right. To the General Register.
To the General Register. Thank you.
Okay. So moved. And I understand you have an oral amendment, Representative Norton?
I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a DE3 amendment.
It is a large oral amendment, so we are going to pass it out, I believe. We have copies to pass
out.
If
we could adopt the DE3 first and then the oral amendments to the DE3.
Got it. Okay, very good. Representative Norton moves the DE3 amendment. Do you want to say a little bit about it?
Sure, I will. This combines efforts in which you've heard about and in this committee, actually, already. The initial bill, which I'm going to have testimony on, and the second one, which was a part of the AARM mental health certification language, which we talked about. And if you remember, I asked at that time if we could do some sort of certification for autism housing as well. And I've worked with the department. And so the section two on there is a new addition, but it will be something that we phased in. And the department is going to do some work on that as they work on their own internal reforms and bring something back as part of their work next year. So I've combined two efforts. They're both about autism housing. And so if we could pass the DE3, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. And then we have a delete all that I would like to hand out.
Okay, members, questions?
Not a delete all, I'm sorry.
No. Questions to the DE3 amendment. We have an oral amendment we'll be putting on it, but any questions on that right now? If not, we will then entertain the oral amendment to the DE3 amendment, which...
Thank you.
We're stretching the guidelines a lot, but...
It is, and I apologize, and I will explain to the committee, this took a lot of work. We started working on this last May, and we've had a hearing in the Senate. We made some changes. This is the Senate language, and it gets rid of the fiscal note. And so it is... unfortunately, I had the language, and they all start the same, and so I sent the wrong one ahead, and it is my error. But I would, if you would please... be generous with me and allow the oral amendment, which I did bring in writing, so I didn't have to read it. But I will read it if you'd like me to.
We'll call it an A1 amendment to the DE3 amendment. And you're moving that, correct, Representative Norton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, it removes Section 1 in the DE3 and replaces it with your handout here, the A1.
Maybe we could give members a little time to read through it and then entertain any questions. And again, this takes the cost out of the bill. That's the primary thing that it does, and that's part of why this is moving to the General Register.
Yes.
Very good. Any questions on the A1, what we're calling the A1 amendment to the DE3 amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Norton, just out of curiosity, what was the change that was able to eliminate the fiscal note? I just haven't looked through it in detail, but I'm just curious how we were able to accomplish that. I'm thrilled. I'm just curious what the change was that we were able to get there.
Thank you. And we'll have some testifiers come up and walk through that. And the department is here to answer some questions. Originally, we had asked for an exception to the moratorium. We were going to add 3 beds as a pilot program. There is a cost to that as well as some complications. So what we have done is, the department will work with one or more counties to start some group homes. They will use spaces that are available and empty currently in other parts of the state, and we're kind of bargaining with the space. We're going to make autism-specific residential facilities for residents, and hopefully we'll have more than one. But we're doing it by using openings that are already there, so we're not creating new ones and adding additional cost. And these are for people already currently on waivers. We're not creating new waivers for the program.
Representative Mack, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Norton answered my question, because working with children with autism does require skills beyond the normal kind of training that they might have. And so my question was, who is going to provide that? But evidently, these are folks who already have that training and are ready to go.
Well,
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's why, and these folks that will come and explain the situation. These are folks that came to us a year ago saying, we have children that are in foster care, and their needs are not necessarily being met. And some had some rather dramatic stories to share, and their children are being placed four hours drive from their home because they're trying to find a situation that's comfortable for their child because of the very distinct needs that they have. And so the second part of this, the Section 2 that was in the DE3, is actually the department's going to work to try to build a cadre of people that will have certification that says, I have some extra training. I know how to work with this particular population. And if we can get four residents in one house with similar needs, and every child is different, so they're not all the same, but the sensory environment needs are often very similar and very unique. And so we are hoping to start working toward creating that kind of model. And then Representative Lohmer's bill, which we'll get to here in a minute when we get all these amendments on and we get this accepted, she has an even broader concept for maybe a village or residential farm or campus that she'd like to talk about as well. But we're going to start, hopefully this year, moving small and then at least propose this larger idea to the body today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And just say, I really appreciate both of you thinking outside the box on this. I mean, that's the essence of good reform is thinking of ways of doing things better. And when we deinstitutionalized years ago, we didn't think about what we would do. And so now we're trying to find places where we can do the best job by these people. And maybe it's something in between a completely independent standalone facility and what we used to refer to as an institution. And so I appreciate your good thinking around this.
And Mr. Chair, I will say, you're absolutely right, and I appreciate those words. And it's that, in addition to a growing population that some of you have heard about in this committee and others, but I think the community at large doesn't really understand what's coming, that the numbers have increased and that we have to provide for these citizens. And it's going to require creative thinking in our school systems, in our housing systems, and in our workforce down the line. And so our Representative Benson just snuck out, but he actually has a workforce bill that he's working on for some of this population as well. So if I could have the
if there are no questions or comments at this point on the what we're calling the A1 amendment to the DE3 amendment, let's act on that. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails, and the A1 amendment to the DE3 is adopted. So now we're on the DE3 amendment as amended.
Thank you. And so that is the bill that I'm bringing for you. I think I've kind of introduced it already. So what I would like to do is perhaps, is it okay if we have...
Why don't we adopt the DE3 amendment as amended?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails and the DE3 amendment is amended, is adopted. Now the bill's in the form you want it, and we'd like to go to Representative Lohmer.
Could we go to Representative Lohmer and let her share?
Very good.
This is a little bit unusual, Mr. Chair, but thanks for letting us do this because our testifiers really relate to both of our bills. So we thought it would be easier if we just started out this way, just sharing our ideas. So,
I like it.
Okay. House file, I need to move House file 2252.
Representative Lohmer moves House file 2252.
I'm not sure where it's going.
And it is moving, I'm sorry, it's recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance because it does still have some money in it. So that's the reason they're each going in different directions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'll just
Representative
explain.
Representative Lohmer.
This is maybe could be labeled an autism campus. In general, this bill is about creating housing options for an increasing population that currently has no or little viable options. So House File 2252 asks the Department of Human Services, the Department of Education and Employment, the Department of Education and Employment and Economic Development.
Representative Lohmer, I'm going to because this is unique, the chair, especially given the hours we put in last night, is not thinking completely clearly. We probably should act and complete the action on the bill before us, Representative Norton's bill. So now that we had adopted the DE3 amendment to the to House File 1683, I think what we should do is vote on moving that to the General Register. So let's do that first and then go back to yours, if we can. I apologize. That's my mistake. So members, if there's no further discussion, what we'll do is complete the action on House File 1683 as amended. And so Representative Norton renews her motion that House File 1683 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Aye. Motion prevails and the bill is moved to the General Register. And now Representative Lohmer, back to your bill.
Okay. I don't think I need to start over. Maybe I'll just...
Oh, I'm sorry. You'll need to move your bill if you
want. Oh, I do. I need to start over. Okay. Yep. Mr. Chair, I move House File 2252. to be passed and
be recommended to pass.
Recommended to pass and move to
be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Very good.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
This bill is about autism campuses. And so the idea is that we would like to have the departments of Education, Employment, Economic Development, and DHS to create alternatives to group homes, something like boarding schools, farms, or treatment centers that have a campus model and could serve the severely autistic population along with other severe developmental disabilities as might be appropriate. Further, we'd like DHS to work with federal regulations and request necessary authorities and amendments to ensure the licensing and funding of said residential campus. So behind this bill, the thinking is that the profoundly autistic population needs a hybrid model that incorporates the long-term care of the current disability model with the therapeutic programming of the current mental health model. So this campus development seeks to create that hybrid. And I know that there will be people here from the department today who will speak against this, and I know I had a great conversation with Steve Larson from ARC last week, and some people are opposed to it, and I think the objections stem from a fear of institutionalizing again. And I just want to be on record here and say that nothing could be further from the truth. My vision is for a positive solution for these families that has trained staff, appropriate environmental conditions, and a choice for people. Right now, people really don't have a choice. It's a four-bedroom group home or nothing. So I never want to see a disabled person with autism or otherwise be mandated to live anywhere. So I simply want to provide this choice. And I think last week in HHS Finance, when we heard from Dr. Hubert and Dr. Zuspan about the fact that a lot of times patients and families don't really get a say, I mean, this whole idea was birthed from listening to one of our testifiers today that came to talk about the struggles that they go through with their kids. And I just want to be receptive to that, that these families need to have a voice. And we did have a very large pendulum swing, I would say, from the institutions to what we have now. And there's challenges in both of those things. So I think we just need to be looking at other alternatives. So with that, I'm going to invite our folks sure, down to testify about the issues. So
we have first on the list to Representative Lomer is Dr. Cheryl Grassi. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Jackie Trapp, Ellis Huoff, Nancy Anson, and Steve Larson.
Representative Gottwald, we have one of our testifiers has to leave early, so we're going to change the order if you don't mind.
Whatever order you'd like to do is just fine. Members, any questions in the meantime? Okay, we'll take, maybe what we can do is take testifiers and then, oh, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, and maybe the testifiers will answer this. I'm just wondering about the 21 years, the limit, because I know that a lot of these young people, you know, need ongoing, and I know there are reasons for that, but I don't fully understand what they are. So maybe you could get that addressed as people testify. Why it's
that something
up to 21.
Is that something the testifiers can speak to? Please state your name for the record and who you represent, and then we can begin with testifying.
My name is Cheryl Grassi, and I am a parent of a child with autism. I also run an autism nonprofit here in the Twin Cities. I'd have to ask for the question to be repeated.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering why it only goes up to age 21. I know a lot of things change in terms of funding and stuff, but I just wondered if that could be addressed along with the rest of the testimony.
Ms. Grassi?
Okay, are we referring to House File 1683 or?
We're referring to 2252, okay. Representative Lomer's bill.
I think it does have to do with funding and that there's a cutoff both with education and with the waiver funding in terms of how we would structure a lower campus and an upper campus for adults or for children. So
that's my recollection too. You know, we can keep this a little organic as long as you identify yourself. So is there anybody else who knows more about that topic who wants to try to answer that question? Okay. Okay, very good. Please state your name for the record and who you represent, and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Jackie Trapp. I'm here with End of the Spectrum as well. I live in Vadnais Heights, Minnesota, and I have a beautiful little girl named Cece who suffers from severe autism. By the time she was three, she was so destructive and constantly busy that my friends often told me I needed to put her in a group home. I, however, held to the belief that we could keep her home until she was maybe 10. Sadly, the constant strain and lack of adequate services took its toll on my husband, Mark. He fell into a deep depression and committed suicide on September 12, 2009. I was then forced to place her in a group home in Brooklyn Center. From the start, I was not impressed with her placement. The home is run down, and there were many safety concerns, which I pointed out immediately. Also concerning was the fact that Cece's behavior therapist was not allowed to work with her in the home, even though I pay for services out of pocket, and even though therapy would be done privately in her room. Now, after 2 years, the group home has allowed the therapist to work with her for 1 hour per week, which isn't nearly enough for these kids. My daughter has a lot of potential. When she was at home, she had behavior therapy and OT, occupational therapy, and she made some very major strides. With much work, we got her fully toilet trained and able to go out into the community. With the help of some very outstanding staff at her current elementary school, Cece has learned to write her name, is learning to copy words on the computer, and is learning to color in the lines. She is still nonverbal, but school and OT are working on alternative methods of communication. Unfortunately, there is no such programming or follow-through at the group home. I have provided sensory equipment and most of her crafts and activities, but they go untouched until I arrive. Staff are improperly trained and often inappropriate. Several staff were kissing her on the mouth as a goodbye. The TV frequently has adult content programs such as sex and violence. Overall, my daughter is very stressed in this placement to the point that she has pulled out most of her hair and she is now bald. I don't know if you guys can see this picture. This is how she normally looks. And
if you're okay with it, we could also perhaps even pass those around so people can look at them closer.
Okay.
If you're okay with that.
I am.
The page can help you out with that.
Thanks.
Thank you.
With the help of my Ramsey County social worker, I've been looking for another placement for 2 years. There are no openings and no group homes that have programming for my daughter. Because I have expressed concerns about the care at her current group home, we now have been asked to leave. How unfortunate that a truly fostering environment is so elusive for this extremely vulnerable population. As an RN, I deal daily with patient and family concerns and questions. I have yet to hear my manager or cohorts ask those patients and their families to find a different hospital. I envision group homes in which family involvement is embraced and encouraged, sensory input is the norm, and the learning my child receives at school is carried through into the home. So I would like to ask if you would please help us create proper housing for these children with autism. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions to the testifier? If not, we'll keep moving with additional testimony and then open it up for questions and conversation. Okay, you've already introduced yourself, so you can proceed if you'd like with your testimony. Welcome again to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have a personal story as well, but instead I'm going to do just a little overview because I promised Representative Lohmer that I would aim in that direction. So I wrote this as a kind of a fairy tale. I did send out copies ahead of time, so some of you may have received it.
And I would just point out, Ms. Grassi, just real quickly, members, we do have each person, I believe, testifying here today, we have a copy of their testimony in your packet, too, so you'll have the benefit of both their personal testimony as well as written testimony. Ms. Grassi, please proceed.
Thank you. Once upon a time, there were big, scary places called institutions where our loved ones with mental illness and developmental disabilities were forced to live. In Minnesota, we worked hard to get rid of those institutions, a process called deinstitutionalization, and adopted a whole new model of care with small group homes and community integration. Around 1990, we began to see an unprecedented increase in one particular disability, autism. Children with severe cases could not always live at home and were placed in group homes with attempts made at community integration. Families began despairing for their children who were quote-unquote institutionalized and isolated in these group homes with only basic caretaking. Rarely could these children participate in the community due to their sensory challenges. Time passed and Minnesota became number one in the country for cases of autism. There continued to be no housing options other than group homes without autism programming. Research was conducted about what other states did for autism housing, and many options were found. Idyllic farm settings, therapeutic boarding schools, treatment centers, and campus-style communities abound in other states. These settings create wonderful communities and meaningful lives for individuals with autism and developmental disabilities. Residents in these settings are happy and higher functioning, and the costs of these options are far lower than Minnesota's group homes. I have in one of your packets a little cost analysis that looks at the difference between the cost of group homes and the cost of different types of residential centers out of state. The autism community needs housing options in Minnesota. We need group homes with therapeutic programming, boarding schools, farm settings, treatment centers, and campus-style communities to improve the quality of life for children and adults with autism and severe developmental disabilities. Please support these bills and the development of autism housing in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I don't know that we do have the numbers in our packet, but if we can get those two committee members, okay, we'll do that.
Sure.
Any, okay, next.
Any questions?
Any questions, members? Very good. We'll move to the next testifier. Just...
Hello.
State your name for the record.
Yes. My name is Alice Pluhoff, and my family and I live in Lake Crystal, Minnesota. 2 weeks ago, my son Nathan was able to move into a group home in nearby Mankato. Although we are happy to have him so close, the process leading up to this move was anything but happy. Nathan is severely autistic. He's nonverbal, easily overwhelmed, and his frustration often leads to behaviors like headbanging, biting his arms, or hitting, biting, and kicking others. He sometimes has odd sleep patterns that keep him up all night, and on more than one occasion he has run away. We had Nathan in our home for 14 years, and that's how we wanted it. In 2010, things became increasingly difficult. Nathan was more aggressive at home and at school. That spring, we admitted him to the behavioral unit of a children's hospital. I was so worried that he would be scared and not understand what was happening. He was hospitalized 6 more times that year before he started to feel better. It was only after this most difficult year that my husband and I came to terms with the fact that no matter how much we loved Nathan and wanted him at home with us, we weren't able to give him the level of care he needed. We started looking for good out-of-home placement, but openings were scarce. Nathan went into crisis placement for nearly 12 months at a cost of $692 a day. We contacted as many group home providers as we could. Many couldn't help us because they didn't have room or they didn't accept children. We did find 7 homes that accepted children and had openings. We applied to each, but once they received Nathan's information or met him in person, they all refused to take him. The saddest experience was when a provider did accept Nathan, but called the day after he had moved in to tell us they wouldn't be able to care for him after all. This was so discouraging. We were starting from scratch again. This was terribly confusing and stressful for Nathan, too, who was sent by this provider to a psychiatric unit in Duluth until he could return to crisis placement. Last fall, we came in contact with Cheryl Grassi at End of the Spectrum. When we found out about the proposed autism housing bills, we felt like we were seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. We shared our story and offered to help if we could. So here I am testifying today that the lack of good residential options for children with autism in Minnesota is alarmingly pathetic. We are only one family, but there are many others living in crisis mode as we speak. Passing these bills is the first step in providing the much-needed home environments where our children can be comfortable, happy, and welcomed by individuals who are qualified to care for them and their complex needs. I would be thrilled to be able to offer my son a home in a setting outlined in these bills. Thank you for your support of these bills and your support of families living with autism. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions?
Well,
yes, Representative Fritz.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your testimony, for all of you. I do see on one of the sheets here, and I just wanted, because I was thinking about the Laura Baker School, which is in my hometown of Northfield, and I see that you have, it's referenced on in this
Representative Fritz and members, this the PowerPoint, I understand we're not going to have time to go through the whole thing, but what we will do is get to committee members the, if there's a place we can go and find that, Dr. Grassi, on a website, or if we can, we can post it as well. We could do that on your behalf, but we also have hard copies of it here. So I think that's what Representative Fritz is referring to. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the cost, and because I have a constituent, he and his wife have a son who was actually born the same time my grandson Jacob was born. However, this young man has, it's as though God had scooped up a handful of problems, and this young man has them all. He's also now totally incapacitated, but living at home yet with them. And he has a lot of what you just described about going to a mental health and facility and having been, you know, kept overnight, and then they were going to place him someplace else. But they did look into the Laura Baker School, and the point I want to make is that the doctor, he's a dentist, he's my dentist, and he said to me, and it's very sad, he said it would be $350,000 a year for them to place him in the Laura Baker School. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, there's a lot of care that has to go into a child with this, or with these difficulties, and there's a cost to it, a very high cost. So I saw that, and I wanted to just reference that.
Thank you for that, Representative Fritz. And Dr. Grassi, I think we will actually go through the PowerPoint. We'll allow time to do that.
Okay.
We'll need to move to the next bill by about 4 o'clock, but I think we have time to do that. So I don't know when you want to do that, whether we want to take the rest of the testifiers. Very good. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and then proceed.
My name is Nancy Anson, and I have a 16-year-old daughter with severe autism who has been living at a Wisconsin treatment center for almost 4 years now. Because there was a consistent and structured environment and a school on site to minimize transitions, which are so difficult for this population, she was able to thrive and make substantial gains. The organizational memory provided by this facility made sure all her caregivers knew her individual behaviors and were able to provide a united effort. We never worried about abuse of any kind, as she was surrounded by many watchful eyes. I only wish there were something like this in Minnesota. It's a sad testimony to our state's claim to be on the medical forefront that we have nothing like this. Now we have used up our money, and we will have to bring our daughter back to Minnesota to a group home with no programming for autism. Other children who have come back have experienced severe regression. We need appropriate settings for children and adults with severe autism. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions? Dr. Grassi, this might be a good time then for us to do the PowerPoint. And then we do have a couple of testifiers who are opposed to these two bills. And I would just take this opportunity to say if there's anybody else in the audience who wants to testify for or against, to kind of give us a heads up, a signal. But I know we have two testifiers lined up to speak after that. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe they were talking about the cost of this. Who is Health and Human Services paying the total? Is insurance paying it? Family participation? Who pays, like, if it's $350,000 a year? Where does that money come from?
Representative Peterson, I think I'll let the authors and their testifiers speak to that, but my sense is it's a maybe an inadequate combination of all of the above. Representative Norton or Representative Lohmer? Maybe you could repeat the question, Representative Peterson.
Okay, Mr. Chair. I was curious, we were talking about the funding for students with autism, and the range seems to be from 120,000 to 300 and about almost 400,000 a year. Does that come from health insurance, from Health and Human Services, from families, from all three? Where does the funding come from for these kinds of either group homes or other kinds of housing facilities?
I think we'll let Dr. Grassi.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll let Dr. Grassi address her personal experiences and some of it, but what we're hoping in moving forward in this this new model is to combine some resources, because certainly when students are under the age of 21, they receive some education services. They may have a waiver, and Dr. Grassi can talk about, you know, how much she gets for a waiver. And there are, you know, other pools of money that come to individuals. And we're hoping that in this different sort of setting, we can, you know, utilize multiple sources and get better outcomes and perhaps at a lower cost. That's our goal. And she can talk specifics.
Dr. Grassi.
Thank you. Do you want me to go through the PowerPoint or directly answer this question first?
You know, I wonder if, in light of the fact that you have a slide about financing, maybe you could spend some time on that slide answering Representative Peterson's question. That way we can get both done.
Okay.
So we'll let you get started with the presentation. Perfect. It's working.
Well, I'm not sure how much time you want to spend on things other than the fiscal piece, but...
We have until about 4 o'clock, okay, I think, so...
I'm going to try to leave this from a distance. Hold on. So the desire to create an autism campus is predicated on a number of things, many of which have already been mentioned, but to create a community life for people that, when they live in a group home, they're very isolated from the community. So a larger setting, boarding school, campus, has the ability to create community life. I guess I moved one too far. Sorry, you guys. The need for people to have choices. Some people want to keep their kids at home. Some a group home works really well. Others would like a different kind of setting, something rural like a farm. Individuals with severe autism can't be integrated into the community. We've talked about that. So they live very isolated if they live at home and if they live in a group home. There tends to be, from my research, better quality of care in these larger facilities. They tend to have, you know, all kinds of recreational things, pools, therapies on site. They just have a much richer life. Mm-hmm. And they tend to make a lot of progress. So because of the integration, they are higher functioning, and that's actually one of the reasons costs are lower. Because just for a small example, if you have a child who's toilet trained, then they don't have the cost of diapers for life, which is, you know, the kinds of things that are built into these costs. Anyway, let's just move through this really quick. Other states, all the states around us pretty much, and states all over the country have all these different models. There are autism boarding schools, there are autism farms, there are autism treatment centers, there are autism campuses, and they are thriving and doing really, really well. So, you know, we've looked at what's available, and we're not really trying to create something new as much as saying, could we have some of these options in Minnesota? We are the number one state in the United States for number of cases per capita. Minnesota's been number one, I think, for 3 years running now. And we have no housing, so we're trying to bridge that gap. The reason we don't have housing in Minnesota is, of course, because of deinstitutionalization, and that Minnesota was very proactive in a good way with eliminating some of the previous institutional settings. We do have some settings that are grandfathered in, like Laura Baker, which was mentioned for Prader-Willi syndrome. There's a school for the deaf and blind in Faribault, I believe, which I suppose would be considered institutions, but are really quite lovely functional places for other kinds of disabilities, but not for autism. Mm-hmm. So we can take a little bit of start looking at the funding now. To put a child in the current option, which is a 4% group home in Minnesota, on a waiver or an ICFMR, the cost range per year for under 18 or under 21 is $175,000 to $350,000, and that's comprised of their daily rate for their waiver, which covers their staffing, the cost of room and board, and the cost of any kind of educational or day programming. All right? Now, these are some examples of different places out of state, and I'm going to go through them kind of quick, and we'll do the cost analysis. But this is the Camp Hill Special School in Beaver Run. Beaver Run is in Pennsylvania. It's near the Pathways School, which is another school for autism outside of Philadelphia. The cost for room, board, tuition for the entire year, that includes therapies, that includes food, that includes everything, is $86,000 a year. So you see a huge difference. And they have a pool, and they have horses, and they have trails, and they have a huge community life. So, you know, we're looking at the difference in quality of life, quality of programming, and cost in these slides. The Chelita Institute, the woman who spoke right before me, said her daughter was an out-of-state treatment center in Wisconsin. This is Chelita in La Crosse, Wisconsin. I know Hennepin County refers quite a number of people with autism to Chelita. It's a campus setting for autism. It is a treatment center. Therapies are on site. School is on site. And the cost, this is the high end because the treatment centers are always more, is $144,000 for the equivalent of, you know, day programming, school, room and board, et cetera. Bittersweet Farms in Ohio is just kind of a favorite of mine. They take age 16 and up, and the cost is $70,000 to $90,000 if people are on a waiver, and if it's an ICFMR, it's a little higher. They have a dual license, so people who don't have waivers are eligible to be there as well as people who do have waivers. Last but not least, the Homestead in Iowa, which is our other closest neighbor, is an autism farm. They also have a day treatment program and a couple of group homes where they keep younger residents. This farm is for age 16 and up, and the cost is $117,000 per year. So here's a little cost comparison. And we can look at the fact that all of these different models, whether they're treatment centers, boarding schools, or what else do we have? Autism farms, all run considerably cheaper than the model of the four-person group home that we have now. They also have therapies on site, all kinds of amenities that the residents have access to that they don't have access to in a group home. So I have a son who lives in a group home who ideally would be swimming 4 days a week, but because the public pool has restrictions about noise and diapers and the potential for leakage of diapers, he doesn't have access to those kinds of things in the community that he does have when he's in a residential setting like the ones that we've just outlined. I'm not sure what else to say about these, and I frankly can barely see them. I think I concluded this just by giving you guys some access to some further ones if you wanted to Google something. You know, there's some web addresses. And I'd be happy to take questions if anybody has anything they'd like to
And Dr. Further. Grassi and members, we can also, we can post this online if you're willing to share with us. We can post that for other people to access to because it is kind of fine print. And Representative Mack, you had a question.
I did have a question, although it has been answered. So in lieu of that, I just want to make a brief comment. I appreciate the slides and the examples of places around the country and the pictures you provided, and just wanted to reference, I used to work at a place in Iowa that dealt with children with all different behavioral type issues, some with autism. And there they did a lot of horse therapy. And I've done a lot of reading on horse therapy for all different issues, but particularly for autism. And having a place that can provide that, it's incredibly effective. It's really quite remarkable to watch how children can be transformed and really benefit from that. And that's just one type of therapy, others swimming, all the other things that you referenced. And so I think moving towards something that, one, certainly looks to potentially be very cost-effective, but to also creatively meet the needs of these children is very encouraging. And so for someone who's seen it firsthand, it's really quite remarkable, and the results pay dividends. So thank you for the presentation. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Mack. Representative Barrett and Representative Benson are next in line. Do you want to ask questions of these testifiers? And then we have two testifiers who will be testifying against the bills. So I'll go to Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I guess I have a question for Dr. Grassi. Sorry.
Me too.
It might even be the same question.
That wasn't intentional, was it, Representative Barrett?
No.
No.
So, Dr. Grassi, I'm really curious and startled by the fact that Minnesota is number one in the whole country for autism rates. So I'm wondering a couple questions, quick questions for you. Is the process for diagnosing autism standardized throughout the country? And are there is some of this due to maybe misdiagnosis or lack of diagnosis in other states? I'm wondering why Minnesota is number one and whether that's truly accurate, and if it is, why?
Yeah. Oh, I think
Dr.
there's a lot
Grassi.
Of people. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Kristen. Okay, this is a question that really everybody is asking. I'm sure we're asking it, DHS is asking it, and we don't really have an answer to it. Are things standardized across the country? No. Even in Minnesota, we have two different types of autism diagnosis. One is a medical and one is an educational. But the way that we, and maybe we are more proactive in looking at our citizens and assessing people, mm-hmm. there's certainly that possibility. However you look at it, we still have these very, very large numbers. So, you know, the numbers are real. In fact, they're probably underreported. And it's also real that we have no housing. So, you know, even if there is a state somewhere out there that really does potentially have more residents than we do with autism, we still are where we are. I mean, this is our problem. We have to approach how we're going to find housing for this population. But we do come in number one. We were in the top four for quite a number of years. And, you know, I don't have an answer for that other than there's a lot of speculation about cause and certain environmental conditions in Minnesota being a factor. So.
Mr. Sure, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wasn't going anywhere with that question other than really trying to understand why we're at where we're at and if it is really accurate. So I appreciate your honest answer. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm trying to make you the speaker Whoa. This morning. I know. Wouldn't you love
oh,
that?
No, no, no.
Mr. Chair.
Do that to Representative,
Representative Gottwald. You know, one of the things that we did, we kind of jumped into this very quickly, and what I would have liked to have done, and we just, for lack of time this year, we haven't really spent a lot of time, particularly in the last 2 years, giving the history, and we spent a lot of time 4 years before that doing it. So just to understand, there's a large spectrum. The autism spectrum, ASD, is a large spectrum. It's from end of the spectrum, which these parents that you just heard represent the severe end. Many of their children are the most severe, all the way to what we call Asperger's, which is very mild, high-functioning autism, which many of us know lots of people that might have some tendencies like that. And so it's a wide spectrum. And the medical part of it is a medical diagnosis with the DSM-4, soon to be 5, which could significantly impact how we define autism, and we have to watch for that. Some of us are a little concerned with the parents. We have a large and growing number with Asperger's. Their children, young adults now, are unable to hold jobs, and so Representative Benson has that. That was what I was referring to earlier. For high-functioning children and adults, we don't have services because they don't meet the other definition that you just heard about, and yet their knees, with a tiny little bit of help, those folks can hold jobs. They've gone to college, many of them, have degrees, and could work. And so when we talk here today, right now we're talking about the end. We're talking about the most severe. But the spectrum is quite large, and you're right. Part of it has to do with the change in definition a number of years ago, which did increase the number. And I believe, and we don't need to get into it in great detail, but when we talked about that, when we changed the definition of autism, we did lose some numbers in some other disability categories at that same time. So I think as we became more purposeful about our diagnoses, it shifted where this population rested, and the autism spectrum did grow. In addition to that, there is a true increase across the spectrum of autism, and as was mentioned, we don't know the reason, and we do have a task force, and Reggie from the department is serving on that, and we have many parents that are serving on that, and they'll continue to study that as well. But I'm sorry we didn't do set the stage for you today.
We could almost spend a whole day or more, obviously, going over this issue, but again, glad you're bringing it forward. I have three members signed up to talk yet, and now it looks like we have three testifiers.
Yeah.
And we got about 5-10 minutes here, so.
I'll be quick.
Are you for or against?
For.
You are for.
Well, House File 1683.
Okay. Why don't we take your testimony first? Please state your name for the record, and then we'll go to the accounts.
Okay. This will be short and sweet. My name is Kim Kang. I'm with the Autism Society of Minnesota, and I'm the outreach advocate for that organization. And for those of you who don't know a lot about the Autism Society, our mission is to enhance the lives of people with autism and to work to educate and support families and people with autism. We are here to support House File 1683. We want to thank Representative Norton, particularly for the certification option, just because we've kind of gone through a similar process in special education. Now we have rules for more training for special ed teachers. So we really feel like this population, we need people who are trained to actually work with them. So we really appreciate that piece of the bill. Also, just the additional housing opportunities through the current foster care and you know, I guess, appreciate her being really creative about not having a fiscal note on it and at least offering those opportunities to people with autism. So that is my testimony.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Members, any questions? Otherwise, we'll take testimony from our last two. And again, if anybody else is here to testify for or against the bill, if you could make your way down towards the testifying table. Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, who you represent, and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota, and I'm here to testify in support of House File 1683 for the same reasons I think that Kim, the previous testifier, did, and for the same reasons that the parents testified on behalf of this. We think it's very important that services and supports be developed for individuals with very specialized needs in this instance, and we think that if anything, this bill is a bit modest and should be looking at how we can support individuals with autism at all ages in the community. And so I just wanted to be very clear, Mr. Chair, that I am in support of Senate file or House File 1683.
Very good. My apologies for that and for messing up your name. I don't know but why I'm keep thinking of you as a Nelson.
Yeah. Okay. But I am here to oppose House File 2252 and share testimony on that. And I'll just be very brief on that. I think there was a fiscal advisory that I saw at the Senate when their hearing was held on this, and I think this area should be studied as far as what are the needs of children, students with autism that aren't being met. The reason that we oppose the bill is because of the history of the ARC Minnesota has in helping to close large institutions and looking at how we can build community-based services. And so I support studying this particular issue, but the way the language reads, Mr. Chair, shall develop a plan to create a residential campus, I think is too prescriptive at this time until we take further look at that. In addition to that, in 1999, there was the Olmstead Supreme Court decision, which very strictly interprets that we have to look at how individuals can be served in the most integrated setting. And last June, and I won't quote it at this point in time, there was the latest advisory that came out from the federal government as far as how medical assistance or Medicaid dollars can be spent. And those dollars have to be spent on a most integrated setting. So I think in a lot of instances, there's school dollars that pay for the types of placements that we were looking at there. But I think in Minnesota, it would be very difficult. And there's even language in our latest omnibus bill, I think, that would be problematic for moving in this direction. And so I would very much like to work with the families. I think their stories are absolutely heartfelt, and that we need to support these students much better than we have and support the families. So we'd like to study this and move forward, but not jump to this particular solution at this time because of the history that I just cited. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Austin, I have a question just real quick. If we set aside, and I realize we can't, but if for hypothetical purposes we set aside the issue of the funding and some of the regulations around it, the insistence on integration, is this concept that's being presented by Representative Lohmer and Representative Norton, is that a concept that you and your expertise and your organization's expertise support moving in the direction of? Because my thinking there is then we work towards changing the federal rules and the state rules so that we can accommodate what we know is best for people with autism.
Mr. Chair, I think that's an excellent question, and I guess I would like to look at if we were successful with implementing House File 1683, could these types of communities be developed in the community in which we could look at meeting individuals' needs? And so I think it needs a lot further study in Minnesota, and I think it's well worth our time to do so.
Great. Thank you. Representative Liebling has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And actually, I was really following right along, had a similar question, and I wanted to ask Mr. Larson whether in his experience he agrees that a lot of what is needed by these individuals and what seems to be missing in a lot of these settings is some attention to the sensory piece of this. Is that something that you agree is needed? And if so, I just heard you say in answer to the chair that, you know, you'd like to see how this could be done in the community. But, you know, do you think if the sensory piece is really important, do you think that we can really, is there anything in the community right now that really accommodates that sensory, that need for less sensory input or careful attention to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I do think that's something that needs to be paid attention to as far as looking at the sensory needs. But I think that We've had homes for people with behavioral issues that are in rural areas because of those types of things, and so I think we do look at the model. What I see here is a breakdown in planning by all of us, including the counties, the state, advocates, whomever. There's intense needs here that are not being met, and yet we are spending millions of dollars to support many people well in the community with disabilities, but we're not hitting the mark, obviously, with these families. So I think there is some intense planning that needs to be done, and that families shouldn't have to suffer in the manner that we heard today if we were doing a better job of that than we currently are.
Okay. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was looking at a website to arrive at the numbers that we're 61 in 67 kids, and in Iowa, our neighbor is 1 in 700 to the previous question, but an understanding that we have approximately 14,000 that fit in the spectrum disorder, and there's either end of that spectrum, what is the population we're talking about that would need this level of care, approximately? Any idea?
I think that might be a question for Dr. Grassi.
Yeah.
Or one of our authors. Dr. Grassi, we probably have to wrap this up in about 5 minutes, if possible, and I know we have one more testifier, but Ms. Grassi. Dr. Grassi.
I did some detailed work on this on the first PowerPoint, but I don't know that we have it up on the screen. So, what am I responding to?
The number of people that might need this type of service.
The estimates are that of the entire autism spectrum population in Minnesota, somewhere between 40 and 60% fall into the severe category, which is defined by nonverbal and extremely sensory challenged. Okay, so these are individuals like the children of the people who you heard testify, can't go out in public, can't hear an airplane, can't drive in a school bus very readily. They really can't be community integrated. So if we take the numbers of, there's about 70,000 babies born in Minnesota every year. 1 in 63, which is our current statistics, would translate to about 1,100 kids per year coming into the system that need some kind of supports on the spectrum. 40 to 60% of those, so somewhere between 400 and 600 kids per year need housing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thank you for those numbers. To me, at least, I was already in support of 2252 and the previous bill. But given those numbers and the alternatives, I even more support for 2252.
Let's take our final testifier, Representative Peterson. I have you and Representative Huntley on the list right now. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Regina Wagner. I'm the Deputy Assistant Commissioner for Chemical and Mental Health Services with the Department of Human Services. I'm also the Commissioner's representative on the Autism Spectrum Disorder Task Force, which has been convened the next iteration, which does involve the state agencies, DEED, for our workforce issues, education, and health. And so we are eagerly looking forward to participating. We've begun a couple of meetings. While the issue of housing and Minnesota housing as a state agency is not part of the task force, clearly these bills have brought to the forefront a very important issue that overlaps with the work of the task force. And it overlaps with the work that the agencies have committed to doing even beyond just the formal meetings of the task force, to really looking more comprehensively at our policies. With regards to the two bills, because I know we're at the very end of your time and certainly over, the department has worked with Representative Norton on House File 1683 that you have passed to include both of those provisions, which are fiscally neutral, which we think are a very good first start to spending more focused energy on what are the needs of this population, which services for adults, which are going to potentially be different than children, do we need to be looking at? How do we develop provider capacity and work with our counties where this placement takes place? The issue with children is a very difficult issue in regards of, the strong public policy that we've had for many years in keeping children connected to the family, providing supports in the home, and so really understanding where we could be doing a better job on in-home supports for families prior to the decision to look elsewhere for that. So, you know, we have certainly learned a great deal from families and the advocates on this that we are taking back into our own policy work, and I think the standards work will be a good next step with that. With regards to House File 2252, we are opposed to that bill. Very briefly, following along with what Mr. Larson said, we have had a moratorium on new institutions. We see this as an institution, as everything being delivered on-site, education, medical, vocational, therapeutic, that there would be, as we see this, no going out into the community. We do take our obligations as a state under the Olmstead decision very seriously. We are beginning now our Olmstead Planning Commission to look at how do we provide living choices in the most integrated setting with appropriate supports. And so this is something that, as we looked at this bill, we felt that we had to speak very clearly that this goes against the trend. I know we did not study extensively the sites that Dr. Grassi has put in the PowerPoint. We have begun to look into those. We believe that some of those sites are purely educational as opposed to a complete residential, and I think she showed a difference in cost. Well, the difference in cost when it's just an educational setting.
Those are
awesome. Well, we'll follow up with you. I don't want to, but for the for some of the other institutions, we know that some of those states have their own moratoriums, and it is not clear whether those institutions would in fact be developed now, given this trend towards integrating and providing more community-based supports. And so I think that it's important for us to all look more closely at the models and understand where our new service delivery and our new community integration is taking us all. But I want to thank both of the authors for raising these issues. We do intend to continue to look at this and to work with our other state agency partners on this.
And thank you for your willingness and the department's willingness to look at this as well. I know a number of people are starting to look. It's a long overdue conversation, and I know we have some disagreements over whether this is an institution or whatnot, but obviously this is a conversation that's going to go on from here, and we'll certainly entertain that here, I hope, in the future. All right, Representative Peterson and then Representative Huntley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I think there's room for both the programs, quite frankly. And I think having a larger residential farm or whatever it might be with all the services, and you can still do some integration. But what I was hearing from at least one of the speakers is that the most severe of the autism spectrum really don't communicate, can't communicate. And to put them in a group home and try to integrate them into the community, you know, if they're four or five, doesn't seem to be very effective to me as a program. So could you comment on that?
Yeah, I think that's really what underlies...
Dr. Grassi.
Dr. Grassi. That's what underlies the entire thinking, all right? And actually, the desire to do a larger center is predicated on the desire to create community. So if I use my own child as an example, he lives in a group home. At his last meeting, he had not left the group home in 4.5 months. He can't go out and get a haircut. He can't go out and get an ice cream. He can't go out into the community because the sensory assault is so great. He lived in a treatment center out of state for 2 years where all the services were on site, and he was very integrated. Now, when the sensory programming is controlled, they have an exponential increase in learning, and they can then go out into the community. So they get kind of a double bonus. They get to go out into the community because they're doing better in a therapeutic facility, and they get a sense of community beyond living. He literally lives in a room by himself in a group home and watches videos hour after hour after hour, and it's not a quality of life for these children. So our desire is to create community and have them as community integrated as possible in a community that works for them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Representative Huntley.
Just a comment, really not a question. But it seems to me that we can have different models, see what works, and give it a try. And I think the idea of putting some of these people in a four-bedroom thing is not really putting them in the community. And they can't provide in a four-bed place the kind of recreational things that they could do in a bigger facility. Now, we certainly don't want them to go back to the old days where they took 400 people and shoved them in one room and were all the beds there and basically forgot about them. We don't want to do that, but if there's another model that works better, I think we ought to allow it to some trials. And with response to Representative Barrett's question, while we have a higher rate than most other states, part of that higher rate is because we have one of the highest Somali populations in the country. And they have 3 to 4 times the rate of autism than the rest of the population state. And the interesting thing to me as a scientist, you know, most of those Somalis came over here because of the revolutions and the terrorism, and they were victims of all kinds of things. So they came here, and that's why they're here. But there's a similar group that went to Norway from Somalia. And by the way, both of them, nobody knows of autism in Somalia. But the group here and the group in Norway have extremely high rates of Somalia. So I think there's probably some genetic problem related to the length of day that we don't have here in the winter that they're not genetically prepared to handle. But they have a huge problem. It's a huge, and it contributes to the percentage overall here in the state.
Mm-hmm. That has fascinated me too, Representative Huntley, is that there is such a prevalence of it among that population. I have a large population of Somali immigrants living in my district. Mm-hmm. We have one more member asking questions, and then we do need to get through one more bill before we get done here. Mm-hmm. So Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I just the doctor and all of you, really, I do want to mention too, because you did mention the Faribault, the Minnesota State Academies, which are in my town, Faribault, and you know, I hope that you've toured there, you've been there, and I invite you to come there because they actually do it right with that population, and you know, I think that, you know, those kids go home Friday nights, they go home, they come back, and they have everything on campus. Because I don't think they have enough, and they never, you know, our kids never have enough. But I think that would be a place to start. I really do, and I invite you to come down and to tour that and get a feel for that. I'd be happy to host you. Thank you.
And with that, Representative Lohmer renews her motion. That House File 2252 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance, where it will get further hearing. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is moved over.
Thank you
to both Representative Lohmer and Representative Norton and all of your testifiers. Very important hearing. Thank you. Okay, members, we have one more bill. Representative Barrett moves that House File 2532 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. Representative Barrett.
Is this a good bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Weiberg, as well.
House File 2532 allows for the electronic prescribing of controlled substances, Schedules 2 through Schedule 5. This issue has been around the Capitol for a little while. In 2007, the legislature enacted a law that essentially requires electronic prescribing whenever possible. In 2010, June, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration put out rules allowing for the electronic prescribing. And so House File 2532 amends Minnesota statute so that prescriptions or prescribers can issue electronic prescriptions for controlled substances. To be short and sweet, the Board of Pharmacy, the Minnesota Pharmacists Association, and healthcare systems like Allina support the bill.
Very good. Mr. Weiberg, welcome to the committee. Please state your name, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Dr. Cody Weiberg, I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. Don't really have prepared statement here, just would reiterate what Representative Barrett has said. Electronic prescribing is fast becoming the standard way to prescribe, and it is something I think the legislature expects, Congress expects, to eventually result in efficiencies and cost savings. We have a problem in Minnesota, however, because the current Minnesota law assumes that, or actually requires, that all prescriptions for controlled substances, drugs like OxyContin and Vicodin, you may have heard of, are either on paper or called in by phone. And so what this bill does is simply allows electronic prescribing of controlled substances when it's done in accordance with the Drug Enforcement Administration rules and the standards that were adopted by the Department of State Department of Health.
Very good. Members, any questions? Anybody interested in testifying for or against the bill? Testimony for or against the bill? I'm not seeing any. With that, members, any discussion? Seeing none, Representative Barrett renews his motion that House File 2532 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails and your bill is moved to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Barrett. Thank you, Mr. Weiberg. Members, we will be meeting at our regular time next Tuesday. We will be at 2:30 next Tuesday. There being no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.